Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. Dr. Davis will present a four-lecture series on the topic, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago, to be broadcast on the four Mondays of February. Today's talk will be Into the Unknown, January to April, 1862. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 24, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Our presenter tonight, Dr. Spencer Davis, is a professor of history at Peru State College and has presented several programs related to this time period here at the museum. We greatly appreciate his support with our programming and with the museum's mission. We're very excited to have him on board for this series of presentations. So with that, I give it over to Dr. Spencer Davis.
Thanks, Mick. Well, I'm very glad to be here and be able to speak on this topic. The Durham staff picked for me the title, Into the Unknown, and that's a very useful topic, not just for these early months of 1862, but for the whole crisis that led to the war and the first year of the war as well. There were many who saw a sectional conflict coming. There were some who even welcomed it. But few had in mind the war that turned out to be a four-year war. And the newest estimate of the losses was 750,000, up dramatically from the previous account. So it was unrivaled in its length and in the determination of the parties and in the losses it meant. And no one really knew what was coming like that. One of the topics that was much discussed at the time was the balance between state and federal government. And there were those in the South who spoke of states' rights, and from time to time, northern states had as well. It's local patriotism that gets the Nebraska capital on here. It's not historically accurate, but it's a local plug, I guess. And the real business of the state versus national, of course, was the power over slavery. There were states with slavery who wanted to preserve it, and that was the basis for their insistence on states' rights. Slavery was an issue, but while there were some who were interested in the moral issue of slavery, many more were interested in stopping the expansion of slavery for economic and political reasons. And of course, there were those in southern states who believed that slavery had to expand, and the federal government, Congress, and the presidency had to be arranged so there was a balance of slave and free states. And so this is the moral appeal. Am I not a man and a brother? But it was a modest part of the larger sectional debate about the position of slavery in the nation. The Republican Party had formed in 1854. In 1856, they had a presidential candidate, John Fremont. He didn't win the presidency, but the electoral arithmetic showed that the Republican Party could win the presidency the next time by winning the electoral votes of the free states. And this was a tremendous change. It made it possible for the Republicans to win with just northern votes, and it meant that a southern party would be a necessity for those who felt there had to be the protection of Southern interests in slavery. And it meant for those who wanted secession that the election would be a crisis which they might turn to their uses. So the election of 1860 was the crisis. Here's Lincoln, his running mate Hannibal Hamlin. The election was complicated by being a four-way race, and fusion means the combination of the other three, and was a strategy that was followed in some states. Stephen A. Douglas was the candidate of the Northern Democrats. Breckinridge, who was currently the sitting vice president, was the candidate of Southern Democrats. And John Bell represented those moderates, mostly Whigs, who hoped there would be no crisis and formed a Constitutional Union Party. Lincoln did not win a majority of the popular vote. He won a plurality of the popular vote, and he won the Electoral College vote. Even if his opponents had pooled their votes in the free states, Lincoln still would have won all but three of the free states, and he would have won in the Electoral College. It's the way our Electoral College system works. 39% of the vote is obviously not a majority, but he won the Electoral College handily, and as he said, following the rules. With this result, those in southern states who were radical, called the fire eaters, had their opportunity, and they pressed forward demanding that their states hold secession conventions. And there was a very long interim between the November election and the March inauguration in which they could pursue this. And I gave you then on the other side of this handout the chronology, and you can see the speed with which the states of the Deep South moved to their secession conventions and the startlingly large vote that secession got in each of these Deep South states. South Carolina, 169 to nothing. Georgia was, the voting was more divided. Nevertheless, it's more than 2-1. And at the conclusion of this, they wasted no time in organizing the Confederacy. You can see it's just 8 days after the vote in Texas that the convention met to organize the new Confederate government. They wrote a constitution, a provisional constitution. They used the U.S. Constitution as their template. They elected themselves a provisional legislature, and they elected Jefferson Davis and Alexander Stevens to be president, provisional president and provisional vice president. And so they were in operation very, very quickly. Buchanan is still in the White House. Lincoln is in Springfield, and it won't be until March that he's in the White House. And they have organized their government. Most all of the federal facilities in the South are in their hands, and they're organized and in operation. Here's the place where this grave political crisis turned to shooting. Fort Sumter was not quite finished. It was still being worked on. It was in Charleston Harbor. Robert Anderson took his small number of troops out there, and they were going to wait out and see what crisis developed. It was thought that Buchanan might surrender the fort. But new members in his cabinet, Northerners who replaced Southerners who were leaving, stiffened his backbone, and he refused to hand over Sumter. And so when Lincoln arrived in office and gave his inaugural address, Sumter was really seen as the flash point, the crisis point. Charleston was the center of secession, and a federal fort there constituted a kind of provocation or a blow to Confederate pride, and the Confederate government would not let it last long, and so it was a matter of what would happen. Anderson needed provisions. They couldn't last very long. And so Lincoln's decision was whether to send provisions only or to send troops. And he decided to send provisions only. And he announced this. He sent a letter to the Confederates informing them. And they determined not to allow this. And early in the morning of April 12th, they began the bombardment of Sumter. And that began the war. The next day, Lincoln asked for 75,000 troops, and the Civil War had begun. The first battle was Bull Run, about 20 miles from Washington. Lincoln told McDowell that it's true your troops are green, but so are the Confederate troops, and you must get into action. And the Confederates also were impatient for action. The battle through most of the day at Bull Run was fairly even, apparently. But Confederate reinforcements came late in the afternoon. They turned the tide, and the Union troops could not retreat in an orderly way and broke, and many panicked. Some apparently ran all the way back to Washington. But the units broke up. There wasn't discipline. It was an extremely chaotic situation. And the Confederates, though they had won, were unable to pursue. They were as disorganized. They were out of food and ammunition. Jefferson Davis went there and said, "Why can't you attack?" And he was told, "We're not organized. We're not capable." And so both sides knew that they had to train and prepare, and that they faced a war with large units in challenging new circumstances. And they spent most of 1861 in that preparation and drilling and organizing. Lincoln's general war order was an attempt to go beyond that and also to get General McClellan into action. The basis of this was that Lincoln commanded, that all forces attack simultaneously on Washington's birthday. And the idea was, with their greater numbers, that they would prevail somewhere. And, of course, this was also meant particularly to get McClellan into operation. This was partly a military planning, but it was also political. Both North and South, the public demanded action and victory, and many expected a rapid victory and were troubled that they hadn't already succeeded. In the Western theater, there were a couple of notable Union victories. Ulysses S. Grant was in command at two of these, and the first is Fort Henry. And it was in a bad situation. The water was rising. Gunboats bombarded it, so Grant didn't have to show a great deal of generalship, and Fort Henry surrendered. Grant followed it up, though, by attacking Fort Donelson. This was on the Cumberland River. And here he showed a hint of what made him a winning general. Fort Donelson was surrounded, but the Confederate forces broke out, and the road to Nashville was open. When Grant learned this, he came to the battlefield. He was 8 or 10 miles away. He came up, took command, figured out that if one of his wings had been badly mauled, then on the other side, the Confederates must be weak, and he ordered an attack. He didn't retreat. He attacked. And as that attack proceeded, then he closed off the road to Nashville, and Donelson was once again surrounded. So this is a hint of Grant's determination and his coolness in a situation that wasn't going his way. After the Confederates were back with in Donelson and surrounded, their officers got into a tangle about what to do, and some escaped and others were left, and Simon Bolivar Buckner was left to surrender. And he asked Grant for terms. He'd loaned Grant money back in the old days in the regular army, and he expected favorable treatment. And Grant sent back the message that unconditional and immediate surrender is the only acceptable thing. And this gave Grant his nickname. It went with his initials, and it looked good in the press. And he became unconditional surrender. These were valuable victories, taking control of the Tennessee and Cumberland rivers. Here's a human side of the war. And this is the death of Willie, the brightest, and many feel the most personable of the Lincoln children. Eddie had died when they lived in Springfield, and so the Lincolns had already had a tragic loss of a young son. Willie died in the White House, took a week or 10 days, and he faded, dysentery or cholera probably. This was a tremendous blow to Mrs. Lincoln, and probably she never recovered from it. President Lincoln was thunderstruck as well, and had several bad days, but he had to return to full-time decision-making, all the while grieving over Willie. Here's McClellan, who was wonderful at drilling troops, but didn't have the inner courage to lead them into terrible battles. He preferred movement and strategy, but direct confrontation he shied away from. He'd won a few victories, small ones, and been propelled into leadership, and then he pushed Winfield Scott out as the leading general. He was relieved of that position, but he still remained in control of an army. He called Lincoln the original guerrilla, and other embarrassing and insulting things, and there were those around him who told him that he might be a dictator and save the Union, and he agreed that he could do that, but he decided graciously that he wouldn't. He is a thorn in the side of Lincoln because he was extremely able training soldiers and had the loyalty of many, but he couldn't get them into a battle that would defeat Confederate forces. The Union had, in the very beginning, decided that they had to seal off all southern ports. Winfield Scott had made that a key part of what he called the Anaconda Plan. But of course, if the Confederate ironclad Virginia could ram and sink enough Union ships, then they would open up their coasts. And the first day out, the Virginia fired away and rammed several, and others went aground trying to escape. And it looked like this would turn the tide of the naval war. But the next day, the Union ironclad chugged into Hampton Roads, and the two of them fired away at one another. You might call it a draw, but the Virginia headed back to its port. And so the Union naval forces were protected by the Monitor, and the possibility of a Confederate breakout into the ocean and trade passed by, and the Union held control of the coast. This changed, of course, the whole nature of naval warfare. There'd been ironclads before, but there'd never been the kind of battle that these two staged. After Grant's two victories, he thought of taking control of the Mississippi, but he needed reinforcements. The Confederates, however, were not going to let him build up his forces, and they attacked him while they had the numerical advantage at a place called Shiloh. Shiloh was actually a small wooden church close by. The Union forces weren't totally surprised, but the Confederates attacked and had success on the first day and drove Union troops back. There were many casualties and losses. Again, Grant showed his determination. He arrived. He took command during the night. He saw that reinforcements were coming, and he ordered an attack for the morning of the second day, again showing that when things were toughest, he would take to the offensive. And the next day, with heavy casualties, they regained the territory they had lost. The losses were of an order Americans had never experienced before, and many wondered if such a war could go on. And, of course, the answer was it could not only go on, but even greater losses were coming. Because of the size and also, unfortunately, the fatalities of this war, the Confederacy turned to conscription, and then subsequently so did the Union. The Confederate Act led to a situation in which you were in for the duration. Union troops served and then went home. So many more troops served in the Union Army. But at any one time, their advantage was not so great as the total number would make you think. And of course, that meant almost everywhere the Confederate forces had much more experience. Control of the Mississippi, which Winfield Scott had thought of and Lincoln saw the importance of and Grant was interested in, was also an objective of the Navy coming up through the Delta and taking New Orleans. And the leader here was David Farragut. He was a Southerner, but he remained with the Union Navy. And I think one reason is he'd spent his whole life in it. He entered the Navy when he was 9 years old, which is which surely wouldn't be permissible today, and I don't know if it was legal then, but anyway, he had entered at nine. He was 60 when the war broke out, so he'd spent 51 years in the Union Navy, and he remained with it. He was determined to take the Navy anywhere that the ships would still float, and the fact that it was a river didn't bother him. He was going to fight wherever his ships would float. New Orleans had been stripped of defenses for the Battle of Shiloh, and so once he ran his ships past the artillery, it was easy to get to and take New Orleans. But he didn't stop there. He went on Baton Rouge and Natchez, and he went as far as Vicksburg, but it was simply too tough a position to take, and he had to retreat back down the river. But at the end of this, almost all the Mississippi River was controlled by the Union. Only in the area of Vicksburg was it in the hands of Confederate forces. Let's take a kind of overview of where we've reached by this time. The Confederacy is in operation. It's achieved its widest territorial boundaries. It has a functioning government. It has able generals, and it has a very large and capable fighting force. The Union has something of a strategy, which is to deprive the Confederacy of trade with Europe, to control the Mississippi, and to begin to defeat Confederate armies wherever possible, and to fight as continuously as possible. And in the Western theater, they'd had some victories under Grant. But in the Eastern theater, McClellan had what Lincoln called the slows and didn't move very quickly. He went through an elaborate plan, the Peninsular Campaign, and he landed on the peninsula between the James and York Rivers. And when he landed, he had an advantage. He had 70,000 troops, and the Confederates had 17,000. And almost anyone would have attacked. But as soon as they landed, McClellan gave the order, dig trenches rather than attack. And so the Union victories in the West were not matched by successes in the East. And so the war was going to have to go on. And the Union, if it were going to win, would have to find better generals to fight in the Eastern theater. The Confederate advantage was clear. So that's where we've reached by the spring of 1862. It's too late to repair the Union. The war is clearly going to be one of substantial casualties, and it would have to be, for the Union to win, a victory of defeating all the Confederate forces and occupying the Confederacy, which was a very substantial assignment. The Confederacy, by surviving, hoped for either a negotiation brokered by European powers or a political change in the North that would lead to a settlement. And as long as they maintained their forces in the field, they were doing the strategy that they hoped would lead them to a permanent independent status in the world. So thank you very much. And now I'd like to answer questions.
The first question from the audience was, could Dr. Davis talk about the leadership of the Confederacy?
At the very beginning of the war, Robert E. Lee had been offered leadership of the Union forces. And he had declined and gone back to Virginia. And he was, in the beginning, a military advisor to Jefferson Davis. And then he took command in the western part of Virginia. And he didn't have much success. And in fact, Southern newspapers criticized him and called him Granny Lee for not doing well. And he left the western part of Virginia. And it was because a Confederate leader was wounded that he actually took command in the Eastern Theater and formed the Army of Northern Virginia. Clearly, he was well thought of by Winfield Scott and others, and he was audacious. He found in Stonewall Jackson a tremendous lieutenant. Beauregard, I hate to play on words, had a high regard for himself, and I don't think he and Jefferson Davis got along, but he had a reputation early in the war. Jeb Stuart was a distinguished and capable cavalry leader for the Confederates. And so they looked to have, certainly in the East, the better generals.
Was the Mexican War a proving ground for the leaders of both armies?
It was. Many of them had been there. Jefferson Davis had been there, and Lee and Grant, and others as well. But I think it was also slightly deceptive because it didn't go on very long, and I think it gave many the idea that quick victories were possible in a modern war, and that turned out to be deceptive. But yes, many of the leaders had been there. Some of them had left the army in the long period after the Mexican War. Yes, many of them had served there. Jefferson Davis had also been the Secretary of War, and he had a high opinion of his abilities as a strategist and wanted to intervene, and especially to sort of pick generals. And possibly his choices weren't always the best, but at least on paper and in the early going, they looked to have the better leaders in the Eastern Theater.
Did Jefferson Davis have success appealing to European leaders?
No, they didn't. They believed in this theory called King Cotton, that England especially, but also France, would need the cotton produced in the southern states and would therefore either be the allies or at least the brokers of a deal. And that didn't ever come to pass. In England, there was an anti-slavery movement, and there had been for a long time. But it's also true they found substitutes, India and Egypt. And also they had a huge amount of cotton on hand from southern states to work through. And so it was partly economics and partly pro-Union sympathy that meant that England didn't ever join the Confederacy. And I don't think France would ever have done anything without England going first. France was tempted, you know, to intervene in Mexico to take advantage of our preoccupation, but as far as helping the Confederacy, it never happened. It was probably a miscalculation from the beginning.
What happened with the officer corps at the beginning of the war?
I would say, in a ballpark estimate, over half went with the Confederacy. There are a number of politicians that left Congress and the administration and took positions in the Southern Army, high position, and there were a number who left. In the Navy, practically none. And I mean, one reason is there wasn't a Confederate Navy to go to, or really possibility of putting it together. But in the Army, there were numbers who did. There were also, because the 1850s hadn't had any major conflicts, there were those who'd left the service and weren't in the Army anymore. For instance, McClellan comes to mind. And for that matter, Grant, who was under a kind of cloud, but he'd left the service. Sherman was running a military school in Louisiana and left it and went north to take a Union position. So there were those who weren't in the service who had been, and there were those who left and joined the Confederate Army. But as to numbers, I'd have to look it up to see how the numbers would break down.
In the early stages of the war, was Washington, D.C. ever in danger?
Lincoln was very concerned that the Confederate forces could march in and take Washington. And there were anxious days at the start of waiting for troops to come from Massachusetts and New York State. And there was a bottleneck in Baltimore, which was very pro-Southern. And so there was an anxious couple of weeks. On the other hand, the Confederates weren't probably organized enough to have done much. But that was a fear Lincoln had in 1862 as well as at the start. Virginia was right there, and Washington was exposed, and so yes, that was something to fear. And Winfield Scott did his best to put together a defensive force, and then troops began to arrive a couple weeks after Fort Sumter. And turned out Washington wasn't really ever in danger, but it was always a worry.
Was it ever the South's plan to fight a defensive war?
Robert E. Lee liked to attack, and so he attacked on the battlefield. But as a general strategy, I think preserving the Confederacy was the first aim. Lee went into Maryland and into Pennsylvania, but they couldn't keep it up for very long, and governors, Confederate governors, didn't want their states to be left defenseless to give troops to an attack into the North. And so they insisted that troops from their state stay close by and every state be defended. And so that was a large part of it. But I think it was also Jefferson Davis's view that surviving intact was the best strategy.
Did the fact that the armies consisted of raw recruits have a major effect on morale?
They understood they had lots of green troops. On the other hand, I can't think of any evidence I know of that it changed strategy. The main problem both for North and South, beyond the average soldier of, you know, staying in discipline in a tremendous battlefield, was the officers knowing what was happening. After a battle started, it was extremely hard to know what was happening. And it was also an incredible demand on their nerves. There were officers who cracked under the pressure and the confusion. And so some of it was not so much the greenness of the soldiers as the unprecedented pressure and complexity of managing these battles. I think that was a bigger issue.
Did Confederate conscription violate the principle of states' rights?
I think there was a conflict, and the answer would have to be that for the sake of survival, some of your principles have to be sacrificed. But it's more than just some principles. It presents a kind of fundamental conflict, and it seems to me one can sharpen this and say it's almost a paradox, and that is to win, the Confederacy would have to be a kind of modern, organized society with a strong central government, and that would forfeit the whole ideal of what they declared secession for. So it was, and there were those who felt this, some governors especially, and made this objection. He left, though he was a cranky guy anyway. But yes, he quarreled with Jefferson Davis, partly out of personality, but also on this issue. And in fact, he left and went back to Georgia. So yes, this is a fundamental dilemma for the Confederacy. To win, they had to be much more organized and centralized than their ideal permitted.
What were some of the difficulties and challenges for both sides in the transition from peacetime to wartime armies?
The peacetime army was tremendously small, tiny force, and so there weren't many ready to be officers, and there weren't many enlisted men compared to the huge numbers that the war had. The Union Army also kept the traditional army to some degree separate from the new recruits. And some texts think this was a mistake, that the whoever was in the army at the beginning should have been spread through all of the new green recruits to provide some kind of leadership. But Scott and Halleck thought that would just waste them. They would be so diluted, it would serve no purpose. So what did they do as training? They lived in camps. They went out and learned drill. They never learned how to be particularly fastidious or clean in their camps. And then they had, indifferent supply often, so that it was difficult. And then they had to march tremendous distances, and it's notorious they threw away whatever was too heavy or not necessary, and so there was, of course they would duck out during battle and come back a day later or dark, and some of course went home. So keeping units together was a difficulty. Politically in the North, it was thought to be the best way to recruit to form new companies and units, and that would give politicians and community leaders a chance to be a captain. And so there were lots of new units formed, and the old ones didn't get replacements. And so their actual numbers went down. And so the union had sort of chaotic system of recruiting and training. And Lincoln understood that. And then there were the political generals, but he also thought that was a necessity. You had to have politically powerful people on board, and some of them even had to be made generals. So it was extremely chaotic.
During the war, what influence did the territories have in needing Union soldiers to fight Indians?
There was an Indian uprising in Minnesota, and it was successfully, or at least successfully from the Union viewpoint, put down. And the over 300 that were scheduled to be executed, Lincoln went through and reduced the number into the 30s. But that took care of what seemed to be the one time when there was trouble on the frontier. The Union troops defeated the Confederates, which I think was a much more important thing to do in a battle in New Mexico. And so the Union controlled the West, the frontier, and California. And the only uprising that was a danger that I know of was the one in Minnesota. It's true that not everybody was concerned about the war, and there were people heading west, but I can't imagine that it was a priority for Union forces.
How long before 1860 was secession discussed in the South?
There'd been the South Carolina nullification movement in 1831-32, which Andrew Jackson had dealt with. And in 1850, there'd been a Nashville convention where Southern representatives were to consider railroad lines, but also to think about organizing on their own. The Compromise of 1850 had heated up talk of sectional division and the Union splitting. The Kansas-Nebraska Act led to Bleeding Kansas, where the sectional rivalries were sharp. So the Compromise of 1820 involved the conflict of free territory versus slave territory. So this was an issue that had been in national politics, and in the 1850s became angrier and more difficult to deal with. The Whig Party went out of business. It had had northern and southern wings and reasonably moderate peacemaking attitude. The Republican Party, which replaced it, was a purely northern party. The Democratic Party lost representatives in the north and became a more southern-dominated party. And so our national politics were splitting in the 1850s, and the issues were angry, and they had to do about the extension of slavery and what the nation would be like in the future economically and also socially, as to whether there would be slavery extended or remaining just in the current states that had slavery. So it was the 1850s, it became a more potent issue year by year.
Was the portrayal of battles accurate, where so many men were being killed and the remainder continued to charge?
It certainly was sometimes, yes. I mean, think of Pickett's charge at Gettysburg. And there were other places where the The bravery of the common soldier was just amazing, and they knew, many of them, the odds. Many of them had pinned to the back of their uniform, where to send the corpse for burial, and it's a staggering bravery. They marched tremendous distances. They fought in incredibly chaotic battlefields. They ran out of ammunition and fought on. It challenges your imagination to understand the kind of commitment. And of course, in the last 6 months or so, the Confederacy had no rational hope whatsoever. And though there were those who deserted, many fought on with just incredible bravery in what was truly a lost cause. And they kept fighting. And so, yes, it is a challenge to understand the potency of their ideals, their loyalty to comrades, their commitment. It is a great puzzle to read and imagine that kind of commitment. Yes, sir, it is. Both happened. There were units that broke and men that fled, but there were instances of tremendous bravery under fire and close combat. Staying in the fight when the artillery were turned on you, and I mean they faced tremendous losses, and many kept fighting.
Was there a group of people in the South who financed the war?
Not who did the kind of advanced planning and calculating that we think of today as necessary. It was only after the war had begun, and then they tried to tax, and they experimented with different taxes and bonds and taking goods. But the Confederacy didn't do particularly well at it. But to be fair, the Union had no long-range financial plan. The northern states had a developed financial system with banks, and so they had a kind of expertise and flexibility to handle the amounts of money and bring in the funds and disperse them that would be needed, and to contract and manage contracts and supply. And so they handled it better, but they hadn't thought out what a massive 4-year war would cost or how it would be managed economically.
What were the strategies to keep border states in the Union, and what was the degree of dissent in the South?
The border states, four of them stayed in the Union. Delaware and Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri. And that was mostly due to Lincoln's skillful political management. There were states that were not among the original seven, but joined the Confederacy. And the most important of those were Virginia and North Carolina. And they did so rather quickly after the firing began at Sumter. So they divided up, and four went into the Union and four went into the Confederacy. A president other than Lincoln may not have been able to have kept even four. So I think that's one of his considerable political successes early in the war. Now, your second question was about areas of dissent in the South. Conscription was one of the major complaints. The other was the way in which they were taxed. And then there were some areas that felt that they were being dominated by a slaveholding elite. And so areas in Kentucky and Tennessee and eastern Texas, parts of Georgia, there were areas that were not loyal. They weren't. In eastern Tennessee, there were actual unionists. In the other areas, they were simply not enthusiastic for the war effort. And then there was the constitutional creation of West Virginia that made a state out of the western counties that weren't enthusiastic for secession.
What lessons could be taken away from the Civil War?
There are so many different possible lessons, but to keep it to this early period of the war, I think one would have to be a tremendous humility about predicting what's going to happen and having to take into account that things can go far, far worse than we hope or want them to. And I think this would suggest prudence because the war was beyond anyone's calculating. The other thing, it seems to me, it would have been well if there had been wise Southern politicians, not so much to think about the financial planning of a war, but to have thought about what a South that had reformed slavery and lived with the fact that anti-slavery was the dominant movement in Western Europe, and how they could accommodate and to see if it wasn't possible to be a minority of states in the Union and live with the reform of slavery without it being the kind of Armageddon and catastrophe that most of them imagined. And that kind of long-range thinking outside the box didn't happen. And so maybe we need to be doing that at all times. Thank you. Go ahead, Mitch, take it away.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College. Dr. Davis gave a four-lecture series on the topic, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago, which is being broadcast on the four Mondays of February. Today's talk has been Into the Unknown, January to April 1862. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 24th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Listen next Monday, February 11th at 12 noon, for the next program in the series, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago. Dr. Davis's topic will be Union Forces Target Richmond, Virginia, May to July, 1862. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.